From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast, hosted by Paul Hanley.
I had the pleasure of sitting down recently with China expert Professor Bob Ross during his trip to Beijing for the 7th annual U.S.-China Strategic Track 2 Dialogue, which we hosted at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Bob is a professor of political science at Boston College and an associate at the John King Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies at Harvard University. He's also a senior advisor to the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's one of the foremost American specialists on Chinese foreign and defense policy and U.S.-China relations. He's authored multiple books on China's domestic and foreign policy challenges. Bob and I first met when I was a graduate student at Harvard University in the Regional Studies East Asia program, and that was between 1999 and 2001. So it was a pleasure to sit down again with him to discuss his thoughts on the U.S.-China relationship, analyzing the fundamental disagreements that underpin the tensions in our relationship. During our conversation, we discussed his views on how China's rise has influenced their push for a regional order commensurate to China's rising status, slowly eroding previous American-dominated global power structures. Particularly in regards to the maritime sphere, Bob shared his views on how China's rise and great power relations between the two countries have been handled in past administrations. And Bob offered some advice to the current administration. Thank you very much for listening to our China in the World podcast. If you enjoy this podcast, do please leave us a rating on iTunes. And also head to the Carnegie website to see more work from all of our scholars. Bob Ross, thank you very much for being with us today on the China in the World podcast. Thank you for being in Beijing for the 7th annual U.S.-China Strategic Dialogue between leading American and Chinese thinkers.
Thank you, Paul. It's my pleasure to be here.
You've talked this week, of course, we've had two U.S. president, Chinese president met at Mar-a-Lago. And coming out of that, I think people were quite surprised. The U.S. administration moved from a very confrontational approach, kind of zero sum. And coming out of Mar-a-Lago, we hear Donald Trump talking about the importance of a positive relationship and a constructive relationship. And this has reassured our friends here in China. And I think many Americans feel that the relationship is in a better place. But you've talked this week, and I think it's very important, you've talked about the fact that fundamental disagreements between the U.S. and China, especially here in the Asia Pacific, have not gone away. And that you believe China's rise is driving a lot of these fundamental disagreements. And I wanted to give our listeners a sense of your analysis here. You know, what is the U.S. concerned about? What are Chinese complaints? Why is this happening?
Well, our discussion of rising powers and instability stem from a fundamental observation that when countries were weak or second-rank powers, they didn't have a seat at the table when we divided up the regional order. But as they rise, they want the regional order to be commensurate with their power, and so they want change. Well, the regional order in East Asia for the last 50 years, 70 years since World War II, reflected American dominance of maritime East Asia. Indeed, America replaced the colonial powers on China's maritime periphery. And China wasn't at the table, and had little choice but to accept that strategic order because it didn't have a navy. It didn't mean it liked it, but it didn't have a choice. Well, now China is building a navy, and it wants that strategic order to reflect its new capabilities. It's not a status quo power. And it should be clear that what China objects to is American alliances around its periphery and American bases around its periphery. And no great power, no rising power, would look at that strategic environment and think it's satisfactory. China would like to expand its influence on its periphery in South Korea, in the Philippines, in Singapore, and say, we don't want America to dominate those countries and have the ability to dominate our waters.
People talk about China's rising power. They always mostly talk about, you know, the greater economic power. But you talk a lot about China's navy and the enhanced naval capabilities.
Well, if you look at the rise of Chinese economic power, obviously it's been very significant. And China's now the major market for practically every East Asian country. But for many years, that never translated into strategic influence. Mm-hmm. That required the buildup of the Chinese navy. Mm-hmm. And that began about 4 or 5 years ago as China began rapid production of submarines and surface ships. So that in 3 or 4 years, China will have a larger navy than the United States. Some feel it already has more submarines than the United States. It'll have a 400-ship navy. And that gives China the ability, despite gaps in technology, to basically make it difficult, if not impossible, for the American Navy to operate in the South China Sea during hostilities. Mm-hmm. That's very new.
What does this do in terms of the potential for the U.S. and China to come into conflict or war? Is this a possibility, given this changing naval capability on the Chinese side?
Well, we have to remember that these kind of great power conflicts don't reflect immediate issues. So people might ask, well, would there be war over Taiwan or war over South Korea? Well, it's much like World War I. The assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand didn't start World War I. There were pressures building among the great powers. So as China rises, it'll increase the tension in U.S.-China relationship as it becomes more and more difficult for each side to get along as their power approaches parity. And so anything could lead to war. But at the same time, war is anything but inevitable. Mm-hmm. No great power war is inevitable. Structure causes determines nothing. So that it's also equally plausible, if not more likely, that our leaders will have the wisdom to adjust to these new realities so that we can maintain a peaceful region as China rises and America adjusts. But that's the challenge our leaders face, is to have the wisdom, the foresight, to show the flexibility and adjustment necessary to keep the peace.
One of the things the U.S. side will have to respond to, of course, is what you describe as this Chinese growing confidence. We have a much more confident leader in Xi Jinping. How do you see this confidence sort of demonstrated in the region? What kind of things have changed in addition to this growing naval capability? What other kind of things have you seen?
Well, China now feels more confident to defend its interests, because it understands that with the growth of its navy, America will be more cautious in response. So whereas in the past, the smaller countries of South China Sea might challenge Chinese sovereignty and China might have a passive response in the era of peaceful rise, today China says stop, no more. South Korea has excessive, by their standards, cooperation with the United States. China adopts economic sanctions and coercive diplomacy. The problem is that as China uses this new capabilities to adopt coercive diplomacy or to show less restraint, America sees it as a challenge to its security and to its alliance system. In that respect, we might like to think the region is win-win, but there's a lot of zero-sum politics going on out there.
Mm-hmm. How about this proposal by President Xi Jinping for a new type of great power relationship? How does this... This has to be a part of this growing confidence and approach with the United States. This seems fundamentally different in terms of how it dealt with the U.S. in the past.
Well, there are a number of dimensions to this. The very fact that Xi Jinping called China a great power is a new concept.
Sure.
Not a rising power, not peace and development, but a new type of great power relations. Mm-hmm. And this, yes, exemplifies the new Chinese confidence. Second part of this is, who wouldn't want to new type of great power relationship? The wars in the past or anything that we do not want to repeat in the future. So it's sort of like mom and apple pie. It's not a particularly meaningful concept because we all welcome it. But the third part of this is that implementation is difficult. And so the irony is that as Xi Jinping was calling for a new type of great power relationship, he was building islands in the South China Sea. He was challenging Philippine and Japanese sovereignty over disputed territories. And so the conflict between his pronounced goal of greater cooperation ran into conflict with greater Chinese confidence and a desire to reorder the region.
And from your perspective, how to date has the U.S., and I guess this is mostly the Obama administration, responded to this growing confidence on the Chinese side?
I think the challenge the Americans experienced from the rise of China to the U.S. alliance system caused the United States to overreact in ways that were designed to reassure the region that we could be depended on and to signal China, don't think you can challenge us at will. And so much of our policy was boisterous diplomacy, mm-hmm. without rectifying or adjusting to the changing military balance. So as the Chinese Navy continued to grow, America didn't try and compensate with anything but diplomacy. So in the end, that diplomacy wasn't successful because the region saw the underlying military balance continued in China's favor.
Are you advocating then in that case that the Obama administration should have responded by beefing up its military capabilities?
Well, I guess there are a number of things. One, we did things that looked like containment. So, for example, missile defense for South Korea, when it was totally ineffective to defend South Korea, the only reasonable intention seemed to be containing China. We developed defense ties with Vietnam when that was going to be useless because the Vietnamese are so close to China they couldn't afford to alienate China. So it seemed counterproductive to signal China our efforts to establish a defense relationship on Chinese borders. So on the one hand, what the Obama administration should have done is say, well, what's important? Well, perhaps the Philippines is important. Perhaps Australia is important. Perhaps Singapore is important. And do what's important and not provoke China with policies that were ultimately going to fail. But the third part was, if you're not going to try and rectify the naval and trends and the naval imbalance, well then your challenges to China are inevitably going to fail and you'll pay a price with no benefit. So that's the challenge for the United States. If you are not going to reorder your domestic welfare benefits, if you're not going to get the defense budget into line, if you're not willing to just print money, well, then the price of resisting the rise of China will far outweigh any benefits, and adjustment will be wiser than resistance. Now, Americans haven't had this conversation. We don't want to discuss the difficult choices of accommodating the rise of China and the trend of China becoming the number one naval power, but that's something that needs to be discussed.
Early on, after President Trump was elected, Peter Navarro and Alex Gray did an article, I think, in Foreign Policy magazine, which was distributed to a number of us, and I'm sure you saw it and read it, talked about peace through security, building up our Navy in response, I think, to China's growing naval capabilities. Do you see that as a possibility with the Trump administration?
Well, according to the Congressional Budget Office, a independent analytical wing of the U.S. government, of Congress, in order to simply reach 308 ships.
And they were advocating, what,
355. Simply to reach 308 ships, the Navy's budget would have to increase one-third over the average of the past 30 years. We don't know where that money's coming from. To reach 355, they'd have to increase 60%. So perhaps to maintain a balance, 355 ships might be worthwhile, but it's not clear it's even possible. And if it was, and the United States built up to 355 ships, well, the Chinese might just build more faster. And the unfortunate reality for the United States is their military is leaner and meaner than the United States is. Their overall budget has a very small social welfare program. Their personnel benefits in their military are very low. So their ability to compete in terms of defense budgets is far greater than the U.S. ability.
How do you see countries in the region responding to this power transition that we're witnessing? And how does that affect the United States?
Well, the political science literature suggests that countries prefer to balance than bandwagon. And I think this is fundamentally a mistake. If you go back and read Hans Morgenthau and some of the classics, it was the great powers balance and the small powers accommodate. And that's what we're witnessing in East Asia. As the balance begins to change in the United States and China, the small powers are less confident in America's ability to defend them. And when that happens, they're less willing to alienate the other great power because the cost could be very high. So we see in the case of South Korea, even the Philippines under Duterte, Malaysia recently, Vietnam, all saying, I have to accommodate Chinese security or China's retaliation against us will be very costly and America will not be able to offset it. And that's what small power is going to do. And again, the underlying change will be an erosion of the American alliance system and perceptions in the United States of reduced security, which will put pressure on the United States to respond. And that's where we're likely to see Chinese impatience and American lack of restraint. And that's the danger in a power transition.
If you had one piece of advice for this new Trump administration in dealing with these strategic issues in the Asia Pacific, what would it be?
Take a very hard look at America's budgetary restraints. Figure out what we can realistically do in response to the rise of China. And the basis of that realism, develop policies that would incur the least cost and the most benefit for the United States. Going back in history, it's been widely recommended that Americans consider what's been called the Lippmann Gap. Keep your ambitions, keep your objectives in line with your capabilities. And if American relative capabilities are shrinking in East Asia, it may be necessary to reduce our ambitions and reduce our objectives. But what the Trump administration needs to do is first take a hard look at just how much we can afford to pay in order to compete with China and then take the corresponding actions.
Bob Ross, thank you very much for being with us today and
My
being
pleasure.
In China with us this week.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. That's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast. I encourage you to explore our site and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next time.